So when I was asked to do this presentation, I was really immediately interested, but I thought to myself, I don't really know if there's much out there on married adolescents living with HIV. And as I got into it and into some of the research, I discovered I was right. There's not much out there regarding married needs of adolescents living with HIV. I actually found about one paragraph. So I think there is a lot of information out there regarding the needs of married adolescents, and there is a lot out there regarding HIV and young women's increased risk of HIV. And every day there's more out there regarding adolescents living with HIV and their specific needs. But the ideas of married and adolescents living with HIV just didn't seem to intersect. And that's why we're here today, to talk about where these worlds collide. Many of you in the room can tell us significant stories, both from your lives and also from your careers, of where you have met married adolescents that have really blown you away. Some may have been stories regarding young women that come from villages where social norms encouraged early marriage. Others may have been told about a young woman that was married at the age of 13 to a man that was 30 years her senior. Others have told you stories regarding where a young married adolescent that might be 14 is immediately expected to have children. And beyond this, we know of stories of partner violence and young women having no place to go. In the context of young married adolescent girls, I did want to bring in young adolescent boys. And just to say that, you know, while there was some information out there regarding young married adolescent girls, there is next to no information out there regarding young adolescent boys. I came across one resource in my very, very scientific Google search. And this one resource was by Gary Barker from Instituto Promundo and his colleagues from Instituto Papai. From 2003. And I think the significant thing to mention is that while early marriage for boys is less common than for girls, between 2 and 24% of 20 to 24-year-old men are fathers. So I wanted to mention that. I want to segue into the world of adolescence and HIV. As many of you know, in 2010, roughly 42% of the new infections in people over the age of 15 were to young people aged 15 to 24. This means that a lot of both married and unmarried youth are living with HIV. This is especially challenging in that many individuals, most individuals in fact, don't know that they are living with HIV. And this is critical as early diagnosis can reduce disease progression and also allow us more effective care. It's challenging today to know how many people are living with HIV, or specifically how many adolescents are living with HIV. There are a variety of different numbers that are floating out there, some for 15 to 19 years old, some for 15 to 24 year olds, others that are just somewhere in between. We hear numbers circulating between 2 and 5 million adolescents living with HIV, and the majority of these are in sub-Saharan Africa. While it's clear in some cases, many times it's really difficult to determine if a young person has been perinatally infected, and that is from the mother to the baby, or behaviorally infected, including sexual transmission, blood transmission, or intravenous drug use. In talking about perinatally infected and behaviorally infected adolescents living with HIV, I think it's important to understand that there are some similarities and some differences regarding the considerations and care for these adolescents living with HIV, and I wanted to highlight just a few. In terms of perinatally infected adolescents living with HIV, they may be more in more advanced stages of HIV and experience more complex obstacles for self-care. They also may have lost loved ones, such as parents and siblings. And additionally, unless HIV is truly hidden from the youth and sometimes from their families, they may not actually be forced into early marriage. In terms of behaviorally infected adolescents, they're in their earlier stages of treatment, and it may be less complex. They may be experiencing denial and fear of their diagnosis, and many times they have very different psychosocial needs. Many of these adolescents have been infected via coercion and abuse, whether as girls or boys, including men, young men who have sex with men. Some were raped, and others were abused by family members and friends. And I think that this is a really important consideration for behavioral transmission. Today, as more perinatally infected children transition into their adolescent years, we're learning more and more about HIV survival for those in treatment and those not on treatment. In 2009, Dr. Ferran and others published a study that revealed that over a third of children who were perinatally infected and not on treatment were slow progressors and were living to a median survival age of 16. Turning the table to adolescents infected later in life, one study from 2002 in rural Zimbabwe indicates that there's no difference in HIV prevention between males and females up to the age of 14. But after 14, the rates jump considerably in young women, suggesting a huge uptick in behavioral transmission. And this is further supported by UNAIDS in terms of some of their more recent data, who note that HIV infection rates for young women ages 15 to 24 are twice as high as those for young men. Last week at the International AIDS Society Conference in Australia, some of our colleagues from UNICEF presented some of the UNAIDS 2012 data that showed while deaths for non-adolescents have decreased considerably, deaths for adolescents have increased by 50%. And I think that that's really important for us to be thinking about and have in the back of our heads today. Over and above this, adolescent boys were 75% more likely than girls to die of HIV and AIDS. We can speculate that the male mortality rates may be higher because more of these young men are vertically infected or perinatally infected, since males that are behaviorally infected are many times not infected until they're in their 20s and 30s. Additionally, we can speculate that adolescent girls have increased access to life-saving services and reproductive health, as well as antenatal care. Regardless of the reasoning, it's important to think about and figure out how we can better prioritize adolescent care and treatment, including adolescent boys, to ensure that successful transition into adulthood. The second point on this slide is regarding adolescent adherence, which is such a huge concern. In one study, Dr. Nachega and colleagues noted a significant drop-off in adherence rates for adolescents over a two-year period in comparison with adults. And so I'd like to ask you all just to think about for a moment adolescence and why this dropout may occur. And I think that many of you may come up with some of the same thoughts that came to me. And that is, there's a lot going on in life as an adolescent and as an adolescent living with HIV. There's a lot going on. Some may be getting their first job. Some may have their first boyfriend or girlfriend. And really, who wants to take drugs when you're having that much fun? You may want to fit in, and so why would you stop to take your drugs? Why would you want to call that additional attention to yourself? Some may be tired, and some have just transitioned from pediatric care into adult care, and that's a rough transition. And lastly, like all adolescents, adolescents living with HIV have a period of experimentation and high-risk behaviors. And that's why I've included the how to dodge a train icon or image up there. Many adolescents living with HIV, like other adolescents, are starting to think about love and sex and starting to think about families. According to one study from Uganda by Harriet Burungi, the desire to have children among all children, regardless of status, is strong, and a romantic relationship is often not regarded as legitimate unless it produces a baby. There are limited numbers of people that adolescents living with HIV can talk to about sex. Yet, realistically, their awareness of and knowledge of reproductive health and family planning and on HIV transmission also is really quite poor. There are limited conversations about sex with parents, and even with providers, it can take on a parental kind of relationship where the providers or counselors are talking about the ills of sex rather than being really willing and open to having a conversation. Overall, there's a huge information gap that needs to be addressed. One study, again by Harriet Burungi in Uganda, studied 732 perinatally infected ALHIV, and it confirmed the need to have such discussions around love and sex and romance. This study gives us pause regarding this specific group of adolescents and their awareness around the use of condoms, the limited use of condoms by sexually active adolescents, pregnancy amongst sexually active adolescents living with HIV in this study, and also the intentions of adolescents living with HIV, and specifically the young women, to have children in the future. Overall, I'd say that this study reminds us that adolescents living with HIV are teenagers, and they are thinking about love and romance, and they are thinking about sex. So moving on to where these worlds collide. In order to better understand how marriage increases the risk of HIV for young women, as has been stated by a number of different studies, we need to be thinking about more about the variations in regions and whether sexual activity takes place in a relationship, in marriage, or outside of marriage. In Latin America and the Caribbean and some parts of sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, many girls and young women may actually initiate sex outside of marriage. In these cases, marriage may and may not be seen as a risk factor. In other cases, however, where marriage may be the first time that a young woman does have sex, we need to be thinking of this risk for these populations and for these groups. In the case of these marriages, these married young women engage in frequent unprotected sex. Additionally, women who marry young tend to have much older husbands, and many times they may be involved in polygamous relationships where the young women are the junior wives. Both of these factors may increase the probability that the husbands are infected and that the age and status of the young woman may weaken her bargaining power within the relationship. Additionally, married adolescents may have less information regarding or less education and information regarding HIV. And lastly, the most common AIDS prevention strategies such as abstinence and condom use may just not be realistic for those married adolescents. While the needs of male ALHIV are discussed very, very little, I would say that the needs of married male adolescents living with HIV are even less. And I keep coming back to that point because I don't want us to lose it. Lastly, we need to be thinking about the different age cohorts and specifically the need to provide appropriate programming to meet the appropriate developmental stage of the adolescent. While a 14-year-old married adolescent girl may have some of the same treatment needs as a 19-year-old, realistically, they're at different places in their lives, and we need to think about that and consider. Additionally, at the end of the day, we need to remember that each young person is unique and has his or her own unique needs. We need to be thinking and talking about the future regarding adolescents, and specifically married adolescents, and other adolescents that are involved in significant relationships. We need to be thinking of improved access to medical care and how we can provide non-judgmental access to appropriate method mix for family planning, and then other pregnancy prevention options that may be out there and appropriate. Additionally, we know that many women, regardless of age, find out that they're living with HIV only because of antenatal care. We need to work to identify pregnant adolescents living with HIV early and ensure that they have a full range of options for prevention of mother-to-child transmission interventions. And we also need to make sure that they have other access to other antenatal services. We need to be working with communities and facilities to talk about the benefits of couples counseling, to bring men into the fold of testing, and also overall family health. In terms of the access to medical care, it's not a world unto itself, and I do realize that. I mean, that would be putting it very simply. I realize that there are various and very important sociocultural considerations and challenges that we need to be talking about. We need to be talking about religion and tradition and culture, which often condone early marriage. We also need to be talking more about gender constraints that come into play and the power dynamics of sex. There are also additional cultural complexity, including who owns a woman that has been provided a dowry or a libola. And additionally, we need to be talking about who owns the children that a woman has had. Recognizing that adolescents living with HIV are here and we need to better provide for all of them, we need to do a better job reaching out and also identifying the young men. And there are a variety of ways to do that, including family testing, couples testing, voluntary medical male circumcision, through the testing of orphans and vulnerable children, and the testing of young men who have sex with men. And then also thinking back to the pediatric days and testing pediatric inpatients, kids with tuberculosis, and kids with malnutrition. Additionally, we need to be working with married adolescents around beneficial disclosure and reducing feelings of stigma. There remains a need for targeted programming and support outreach for married adolescents living with HIV to ensure developmentally appropriate and relevant youth-friendly services. This takes place both through the clinical provision as well as through community provision, including peer support groups. Some of these services may include support groups that talk about care and treatment as well as adherence. And then we also need to be talking more about HIV prevention opportunities while working with spouses and for children and babies. And we need to be talking about sex and family planning needs. The support groups may or may not involve other adolescents living with HIV. They may include adult HIV support groups as well, but we need to be cognizant that the needs of married adolescents living with HIV are unique and that there are some additional considerations that we need to be thinking about and reaching out and providing attention to. We also need to be thinking more about the legal rights of married adolescents, both in terms of their right to consent to HIV testing, which is an unclear area in many countries, as well as their legal rights in terms of abandonment and the children that they have. Additionally, while young women remain a key focus of our HIV prevention care and treatment activities, we need to keep young men on our radar as well as they transition and marry. Lastly, I want to leave us with thinking about the importance of adherence support, as adherence support remains critical and just hugely important in all of our work with adolescents living with HIV. These two groups will likely have some similar and some different barriers to overcome in terms of adolescents living with HIV that are married and those that are unmarried. But both require the support of both clinics and communities alike. Overall, we need to do whatever it takes to adapt our programs to meet the needs of adolescents living with HIV, both those that are married and those that are unmarried.